on WGN. Happy Monday to you, Elise Glink. How was your weekend?
Lovely. What gorgeous weather. How about you?
Yeah, pretty good. Did you go to the Taylor Swift concert?
No. No, I didn't, but I know a lot of people who went. They all had a great time.
And I just got a note from somebody who went Friday and Saturday night. Mm-hmm. And we asked about the commutes to and from, and what I'm hearing was it was pretty well managed. So what do you know? Chicago did something right this weekend.
You know what? That should be celebrated. And also the fact that Taylor Swift apparently swallowed a bug and survived. So good for her.
Let's talk a little bit about the jobs numbers. Let's talk a little bit about the Fed. Just what's your overview starting the week here?
I got to tell you, the job market has outperformed everybody's expectations, and not just by a little, John, by a lot. We have one of the strongest job markets I think we've ever seen. And, you know, we've created millions of jobs. This coming out of, you know, a pandemic, which nobody had ever been through who's alive today, except a few people, I guess, who are over the age of 100. But when you look at, you know, how people are getting hired, the number of jobs that are available, the wage increases that people are getting, it's just a very, very strong market. And, you know, it's interesting because people have been saying, oh, we're going to have a recession in 2023. Back half of 2023 is going to be really tough. But I don't know. Nobody's really seeing the signs of that just yet.
They keep talking about the lag between certain indicators or certain triggers and then the actual effect of them. So I'm willing to guess that we're not out of the woods, but I don't think many people have felt recessed yet.
Yeah, I wonder how they're going to feel once August 30th hits and they all have to start paying back their student loans. So this has been a hidden risk that we've seen for a while, and the Biden administration has been working hard to expand the forgiveness programs that they have direct control over inside the Department of Education and to get the wheels of those forgiveness programs going, because they basically shut down during the Trump administration. And they have done that. And, you know, we read occasionally about 1 million people here or 2 million people here, 8 million people get their loans forgiven. But there are still 30 million people who have federal student loans and a lot of other people who have private student loans. And for them, that bill is coming due.
But the Supreme Court still could judge that the Biden administration has the authority to forgive $10,000 and $20,000, right?
They could, and that's actually one of those things that I think the Biden administration is counting on. So, you know, the Biden administration said, you know, we'd like to forgive $10,000 to $20,000, depending on the type of loan you have, the configuration of anybody who has federal student loans. And that would really wipe out a huge chunk of those loans. Now, there's a lot of political support and at the same time, a lot of political opposition to this. And now, you know, the Biden administration, as you know, got sued. And now the Supreme Court is expected to rule any day because, you know, June up to July 1st is when their term ends, this, you know, current term of the Supreme Court. And so they typically will kick out the most contentious and I think stress-inducing of their rulings right at the end, and then they all go on vacation for a couple of months, and then they come back in October. And so we don't really know what's going to happen. In the meantime, we also don't know what's going to happen because nobody has ever switched on, just like nobody had ever switched off student loan payments for 30 million Americans all at once.
Yeah.
And they're now going to do that, and it could be chaos.
So we can talk more about this after a quick break here, but my understanding, too, is that the Fiscal Responsibility Act, which the president signed, which has raised the debt ceiling again, said that the loans have to be paid starting within 60 days, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if the Supreme Court comes back and says $10,000 is forgiven, lucky you, maybe you've got $11,000, you'll still have $1,000 you owe. You have to start paying that in 60 days, regardless of what the Supreme Court says. And if they say nobody gets forgiveness, it's 60 days. The 60-day clock is now running, right?
That is all correct. Your understanding is correct. And that's that if anything is going to tip us into a recession, it could be that. and happy to talk more about it.
We're talking to Elise Glink about all things financial, often real estate. Let's just wrap up a few thoughts about the student loans. You said that repayment, Elise, of the student loans at the end of the summer might actually be the last domino to get us into a recession.
It's going to happen probably right at the end of the year. So as you pointed out just before we went to the break, the debt agreement that Congress came to and that President Biden signed requires federal student loans to restart the payment process August 30th. Yeah. And they're going to turn on the system for 30 million borrowers all at once. And I'm expecting glitches and a little chaos, and people are going to have some wrong numbers in there. But, you know, we can talk about what people need to do to get back on track. But now we're going to start seeing people who are very, very stretched financially, right? So even with the raises and the jobs and all that, you still have about 64 to 66% of people, including 50% of people making $100,000 or more, saying that they are living paycheck to paycheck. Well, if you're living paycheck to paycheck and suddenly you've got a $200, $300, $400 bill that you weren't planning for every single month, i.e. your student loans, I think that's going to cause an extreme amount of stress for a lot of Americans who aren't going to know what they can do. And it could cause them to just cut way back on their spending.
Sure.
And that could be the thing that tips us over.
So while one of your headlines today is the case for a recession is crumbling, this may be one of the challenges to that. My son has not had to pay on a student loan. He went to school during the pandemic, got his master's at Loyola. He's got about $20,000 out that he hasn't had to pay on. So the extra $200-$300 he has in his pocket these days that he's going out with friends, he's saving some, but he's spending plenty of it, is now going to go to his student loan. And multiply that by 30 million, and suddenly you have a lot less money being churned through the economy with fewer, just help me with this now, with fewer dollars chasing goods. Maybe prices will go down. Mm-hmm. And maybe that will help at least lower the rate of inflation out there. That's good for the that's good for that problem with the economy. That might bring prices down a little bit.
Yeah, it might bring prices down. But if you look at what Bank of America CEO Brian Monahan said earlier today, or maybe it was over the weekend, the Fed, right now, the Fed's raising of interest rates has brought down inflation where he thinks it's consistent with 2% growth, 2% inflation, not 4, 5, or 6% inflation. We just aren't really feeling all of that yet because some things still have super high inflation and some don't. But we're seeing prices in some cases start to settle down. The biggest driver, or one of the biggest drivers of that right now, is the cost of rent. And the problem with higher rent is that it gets locked in for at least a year at that higher level. Whereas with home buying prices, you can see that start to come down. And in fact, I was just on the phone with a source who lives in Texas, in Austin, and he was saying that, you know, from a real estate perspective, there's more inventory on the market there than has been in the last 5 or 7 years. And so when you start to see those changes, those have a direct impact on the overall inflation number, but they don't have a lot to do with what you pay for gas or what you pay at the grocery store. And so to your point, those things need to come down to make us all feel better about what's going on with inflation.
I saw a number this morning, 3 out of 5 properties in Chicago are cheaper to buy than rent, that rents are still very high. It would be better off if you could buy it, but maybe you don't have the money. Maybe homes aren't for sale, but rents are very high in Chicago. Do you see that coming down anytime soon?
You know, it's interesting. If you look in River North, there are, in that area, Streeterville, River North, there's a number of extremely high-priced, almost New York-priced properties that are starting to come into the marketplace, starting to open up. And people are paying for a small studio upwards of $2,000 a month. That it truly is East Coast prices that are coming here. And the reason is that these buildings are all brand new and they have a lot of amenities they're paying for. And so it's kind of shifting a little bit the cost. There are affordable places in Chicago, but yes, other places have risen their rates. And so it's expensive here.
Is one of those the Jeannie Gang building? Is it the St. Regis that is in that area?
Yeah, I think that's one of them. There's one place, which I think is Jim Lechinger's company. Jay, I don't remember what his company is called, but he's the developer of it. That opened up. There's some around where Wolf Island, I think. There's some properties. Wolf Point, thank you.
Yeah.
Some properties around there that
yeah,
actually
that's
they're the
over
people.
There.
Yeah, lovely right now. They're a little worried about what happens when the casino opens. But, you know, can't have everything.
Yeah, that Wolf Point where the river branches north and south is, I was just there the other night because it's where Gibson's Italia was. So I
yep.
was just looking at the ongoing development there and the views, the vistas, the location. I could see why that would cost a lot of money. All right,
yep.
We are out of time today. We'll listen for you Sunday morning with Tom Fortino at 7 a.m.
You bet, John. Thank you.
You know, often we hear from people that listen to the Wintrust Business Lunch who are just small business owners, and they appreciate any perspective we can give them, either on interest rates in the economy or personal finance. Sometimes we speak directly to small business owners about their business. Laura Dribben joins us now. She is the founder of something called Peridius Consulting, and she knows a thing or two about the scary waters of managing your own private small business. Hey, Laura, you're on WGN. Thanks for giving us some of your thoughts.
Thanks, John. I appreciate the time today. Nice to talk to you.
What does Peridius mean? What's that word?
It is a Latin word meaning more experienced. That was a name change that came from a company in Chicago, sort of an auction marketing firm.
Oh,
so
no
they helped
kidding.
Us with the rename,
yeah.
Yes.
I understand there are businesses that do that, help people with URLs or names of products or the brands themselves. So you kind of reached out to somebody with that, huh?
I did. It was quite some time ago when we renamed our company. So, yes, we've been around for 33 years, but that name has been probably around for, I think we're about 15 to 20 years ago we renamed it.
You work with small businesses, do you?
No, we don't, actually. So Peridius Consulting, we're a management consulting firm focusing exclusively on program and project management services. We call it outcome management. So we tend to work with Fortune 1000 companies and private equity firms, and we help to manage their large-scale complex initiatives. Typically, the ones that involve a lot of disparate types of resources, such as tier one consulting firms or system integrators or other third parties, plus their own internal staff.
Hmm.
And we serve as that check and balance, helping to bring them all together as an integrated team. Sorry.
Yeah, right. So it sounds like if you've got a lot of moving parts, it would be helpful to have somebody just oversee everything, make sure everything is getting done properly, huh?
Exactly. Think of it like an orchestra conductor. We don't play every instrument, but we know how to bring everyone together and make music.
But you would think that the company that was engaging all of these other businesses would have their own project manager managing that. So what do you bring to it that isn't already being done?
Sure. So some of the things that we bring is an objectivity. First of all, it is not always easy to manage other third parties, the tier one consulting firms. It can be difficult to manage them. So our team is experienced in that. And also sometimes our clients don't have that staff. And other times it just may not be viewed as objective. So when one department brings a leader to the table, there may be some concerns from the other departments that there's a bias. So we do bring that objectivity to the table and the experience. So our people tend to be very seasoned, senior-level consultants that know how to, go through the chaos of these efforts.
Yeah, right. I would imagine a lot of A-type personalities there. You must have learned to do some delicate dancing, I would say.
Yes, we do. It's actually funny that you say that because I actually hire not just for project management skills, because I feel like there a lot of people have those. I tend to hire for the soft skills. how do you manage a dissenting sponsor, or how do you, or one that isn't really, doesn't want to really be involved, and you still need their support. So we tend to look for people who know how to maneuver, as you said, those complex situations.
I don't know how you find those people or what those exact traits are, especially since that might seem to be in competition with what maybe you would typically look for, right? Organized people with strong personalities who can get the job done. But these soft skills, I don't know if they teach that in business school, would seem to be invaluable.
They do not, is my experience. I think that is a learned thing, which is probably why some of our staff are probably a little bit more seasoned in that space, because I'll be honest, when right out of school, I don't know if I could have done what we're doing now. So I think there's, I think that's somewhat learned in business. How do you maneuver? And even though we're an outsider, there's still politics in every situation, or even just, as I said, when you are doing a large transformative type of initiative like we do work on, you're going to have some people who don't really want to do it, or who don't really haven't bought into, is probably the better way of saying it, haven't really bought into the desired outcome. So how do you get them on board? That's a skill in its own right.
I'm thinking of my friend Kelly Leonard, who does a podcast here, works at Second City, the comedy house in Chicago, but on their business initiatives. And one of the things he always talks about is getting to yes and. So, getting people to, affirm what they bring to the table, but gently maybe steer them in a direction that's more for the common good. You must appreciate that.
Oh, John, I actually took an improv class at the IO Theater before COVID. So for that very reason, I figure it could help. And I know at least one of my consultants joined afterwards because it's an invaluable skill.
For all of us, just give me one example. I don't have a lot of time here, and I won't ask you to go into detail, but can you describe for me a project that you all have worked on?
Sure. One of them, digital transformation is popular right now is a term, and we've worked on a number of those. But the one that I'll share with you involves a large acquisition integration, two companies trying to find their way to merge together both, tech systems as well as processes and people. And so we actually helped to oversee that whole process. What systems should be integrated, which systems should be chosen, what processes, how do we integrate the two teams together, and how do you get buy-in? That's one of the things that we focus in on as well. So that's an example that a lot of organizations may be able to understand. We are agnostic, both industry as well as industry as well as functional. Uh-huh. So we'll work with IT, we'll work with HR and marketing, or we'll work on enterprise initiatives. And so in an acquisition integration, it affects everybody. Those are the programs that we really like to work on, where there's a lot of moving parts.
Well, I'm glad somebody does like to work on it, because I can just imagine company A has the way they do their email and the way they do their reports and their software, and company B might be completely different, and now they're going to be one. So who's going to manage that integration, or at least make it a soft landing for everybody? And it sounds like Laura Dribbins, your person to help handle that, the founder of, now I want to make sure I get this name right again. Is it Petritus or Peridius
Consulting.
It's a Latin word. We've learned something here today. Laura,
it is.
Well done. Thank you for your thoughts, and good luck. Congratulations.
All right. No, I appreciate the time, John. It was nice talking to you, and thanks so much.
Interesting that there's a company like that out there doing that. We're doing the Wintrust Business Lunch. We've got more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. Allstate has joined State Farm in not accepting new property insurance customers in California. Both insurers say the decision is in response to high losses caused by wildfires. The Illinois-based companies have been grappling with high catastrophe losses, not just in California, but also Florida. Those costs have been partially driven by prices for replacement construction. California is the second largest source of premiums for Allstate after Texas. In 2021, State Farm and Allstate were the first and third largest homeowners insurers in California. The Kraft Heinz Company has launched a new global ad campaign that features the Heinz ketchup brand prominently. Ad Age says it's the first time in the company's 150-year history where the brand is featured in a unified global campaign. The ads show people with the rational love for Heinz. One commercial shows a woman taking mini ketchup bottles from a hotel room service cart and people with tattoos of Heinz ketchup bottles. The new campaign will run on various mediums, including TV, online video, social, and at the movies. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Now the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Thank you, and happy Pride Month.
Thank you very much.
Okay, more from him after I tell you we're sponsored by the Chevy Silverado HD. Experience your life in HD. Visit ChevyDriveChicago.com. Okay, it's Pride Month, and here's a generalization. Rural America is not as accepting of LGBTQ people as big cities are. Small farming communities, small schools.
I had 120 K-8 in my school.
And Riley Hinchy has painful memories of being bullied and made fun of.
I would never want somebody to go through what I did. And so if I can find a way to make sure that every kid feels important or every person feels important that I'm around, I really try to do that.
And he's doing that as the ag teacher and FFA advisor at Streeter High School, about 100 miles southwest of Chicago.
I'll be entering year 10 coming in August.
Riley, I can't imagine there are that many gay ag teachers in Illinois.
Well, there's actually quite a few.
Riley's journey to coming out took a while.
When I graduated from high school, I was not. When I graduated from college, I was. And my mom looked at me and said, "What took you so long?"
But here's the thing. It's not that he's a gay ag teacher as much as he's an ag teacher who just happens to be gay.
When I came to Streeter High School, although I was out to a lot of people, I didn't say anything to anybody. I never told anyone because I knew I was there to do a job.
Yeah, he's done it well. His students have been honored at the national level, as has he more than once, and that ag program at Streeter High School is booming.
I have 173 students. We'll have 216 next fall.
With a lot of diversity.
We're no longer seeing agricultural education as you needed to be a farm kid and then you needed to be a male and then, okay, well, we now let females in. We are now seeing agricultural education wide across the board. There's so many different forms of that diversity.
And that inclusivity has affected other parts of the school.
I've had colleagues that have said, you know, we appreciate what you bring to the table. How can we make our places better for our students to make them feel safe and included?
Riley Hinchy, ag teacher at Streeter High School. From the farm to your belly, today's National Veggie Burger Day. It's National Gingerbread Day. And to wash it all down, it's National Moonshine Day. I'm Steve Alexander, and that's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Elliot Richardson's here, co-founder and president of the Small Business Advisory Council. We visited before, Elliot. What have you guys been advocating for small businesses in Chicago lately?
Hey, John, great to be here. Well, we're doing a lot. You know, one of the biggest issues that we've had over the past couple months has been outdoor dining in Chicago, because people in this city love to eat outdoors. And that was true before the pandemic. And it really solidified during the pandemic when people couldn't congregate indoors. And there was a whole bunch of concern by restaurants and taverns as the summer approached, that these rules that expanded outdoor dining in Chicago weren't going to be here this summer. And, you know, thankfully, an ordinance was just passed. It was a huge win for restaurants, taverns, small businesses, and neighborhood business districts that expanded outdoor dining so people can enjoy their time outside, eat dinner, eat lunch, have a drink. And it's really exciting.
How late does it run till? Is this till October?
Yeah, it is. It's May to October, I believe, and it does several different things. It allows restaurants and taverns to extend their sidewalk cafes to neighboring storefronts, John. It allows people to use their own parking lots, restaurants to use their own parking lots to serve patrons. It allows three businesses to come together and ask for a temporary street closure so you can have those wonderful experiences outside. And, yeah, it really allows restaurants and taverns to maximize their outdoor dining.
Boy, and think of how pleasant and dry May has been. If there was ever a month for this kind of experience in Chicago, it was this year.
Absolutely. And, you know, every nice day sort of added to the urgency to get this done, to clarify the rules for small businesses and restaurants, because, of course, thriving neighborhood business districts not only help restaurants, they help all the businesses around them. And, you know, the new administration acted quickly. The city council acted quickly. They all came together, and out came this ordinance really in very, very fast time that's going to immediately make an impact.
Now, Elliot, are you just Chicago? Because I know Arlington Heights, a lot of the suburbs do this sort of thing as well. I wonder if they have the same luxury that we've got in Chicago.
You know, so we are statewide, but I can tell you we get into these issues in the suburbs. You know, we do a lot of state work on things like health insurance reform and trying to supplement the workforce. But I can't really speak to what's going on in the suburbs. They all have their own rules. Hopefully they're doing everything they possibly can to help their restaurants and their commercial corridors thrive.
So we've got that in Chicago for sure through October, the Small Business Advisory Council, advocacy council. It's good to know that outdoor dining is alive and well in the city, Elliot. Thanks for your time and congrats. Good work on that.
Hey, John, thanks so much. It was a huge, robust coalition that got this done. We're excited that it is now enacted.
Elliot Richardson, co-founder and president.